productive, and it should be his amount of a lot of growth. I wanted to backtrack a little bit, although this Parshas Lech Lecha, I wanted to go back to something about Parshas Noach that's important to know generally. And we know that although Klal Yisrael has 613 mitzvos, but there's also a Torah for the non-Jewish world, and the Torah for the non-Jewish world is called the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, the Seven Commandments of Noach. This is the universal Torah, so to speak, for the entire world. In fact, the way it's sometimes described, it's very interesting, that instead of saying there's a Jewish religion, the religion of the world is Noachidism, and the Jews are the Kohanim of the Noachide religion, meaning to say the same way our Kohanim have a few more mitzvahs than the regular Jew, but it's still Judaism, so too. There is Noachidism, and the Jew is the Kohen of the Noachide religion that gives us 613 commandments. So first of all, the reason why they're called the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach is because all human beings are descended from Noach, because everybody else was wiped out. But in reality, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that the bulk of these commandments were given to Adam HaRishon. So we're talking about the original mitzvahs that were given. The only reason why we don't call them Sheva Mitzvos of Adam HaRishon is because Adam HaRishon, right, one of the seven Noahide laws is not eating an aver min achai, a limb that is severed from an animal that is alive. Adam HaRishon was a vegetarian. He was not allowed to eat any meat. So as a result, he also had seven, but instead of aver min achai, it was not eating any meat. And as a result, therefore, in their final form, we call them the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach. Now, just to enumerate them, which everyone knows what they are, there is an Isser of Avodah Zorah, an Isser of idolatry, meaning an obligation to believe in God. So if a non-Jew is either a pagan or an atheist, he is transgressing that first mitzvah. Now, if we stop right there, that raises all sorts of interesting questions. So a non-Jew is not allowed to be an idolater. A non-Jew is supposed to believe in God. So what is the status of Christians? What is the status of Muslims? All these different religions. So Muslims, although Muslims are very good in terms of this one. They tend to violate the murder and the other restrictions. But Islam is a monotheistic religion. And indeed, going all the way back to the Rambam gave us a psak that although he personally held that Muhammad was Meshuggah, and he writes in such a letter, but he says Islam is a monotheistic religion, it is not a Avodah Zarah. With respect to Christianity, and of course Christianity has many different forms, Catholic and different Protestant groups, that is a very, very big machlokas rishonin. What is the Jewish attitude towards Christianity? Now, be sure you understand the obvious. For a Jew to become a Christian, like a Jew for Jesus, that absolutely is usher, simply because even if Christianity is not idolatry, it is a kafira in the eternity of the Torah, because the whole idea of Christianity is that the Torah was superseded by a new covenant. So we're not talking about can a Jew become a Christian and still be a Jew with mitzvahs. That certainly is not permitted. But vis-a-vis a non-Jew, is a non-Jew an idolater if they are a Christian? So this is a big, big machlokas. The Shita of the Rambam, and this was censored, so it's not in the Mishnah Torah, it was taken out, but the original version of the Rambam is that Christianity is considered to be idol worship, and therefore all Christians are in violation of the first Noahide law. Now, what did the Rambam mean by Christianity, right? What did the Rambam mean by Christianity? So keep in mind that the Rambam lived in the 1100s, and that is before the Reformation. So the only Christianity that the Rambam was familiar with, the only one that really existed, were different sects, either Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, or the Greek Orthodox, as it became called later. In other words, it's pre-Reformation. And all of those Christianities believe in what is called the Trinity. Now, I don't want to give you a share on Christianity per se, but suffice it to say that all of those religions did believe that within Yashka there was an aspect of divinity. And therefore the Rambam maintained that that is idolatry. Now, that has a lot of implications, by the way. Let me give you a few implications. Number one, it means, according to the Rambam, anyone that professes the divinity of Yashka is considered to be an idolater under the seven Noahide laws. Number two, that also has implications regarding Eretz Yisrael, because the Torah prohibits the Jewish people, from letting idolaters live in the land of Israel. Non-Jews can live in the land of Israel. Again, let me just differentiate two halachas. It's interesting to know. There are two halachas regarding non-Jews in the land of Israel. Halacha number one is, we are not allowed to sell land to non-Jews in the land of Israel. This is a law in the Torah. This law is called Lo Sechaneim. Do not give them an encampment. Do not give them a presence. But we're in a Shemitah year now, and as you may know, the Rabbanut actually sells land to non-Jews because they based on a pesach that you're allowed to farm the land if it's owned by non-Jews. But the Chazon Ish had many objections, but then maybe I'll give you a shir on that a little later on. But the Chazon Ish's main objection was it's an issur d'oraisa to sell land to a non-Jew. Now, with respect to that rule, most Rishonim say it makes no difference if it's an idol-worshipping non-Jew or a non-idol-worshipping non-Jew. Non-Jews are not supposed to own land in Eretz Yisrael. That's why even to an Arab, that would be a problem, like most opinions. Now, there's a second halacha, however, that even if a non-Jew does not own land, a non-Jew is not supposed to be allowed to live in the land of Israel. That's a separate issue. But that only applies to an idolater or a pagan. That does not apply to a monotheist. So the upshot would be that in a pure halachic state, which of course we're not, in a pure halachic state, an Arab, according to the Rambam, would not be allowed to own land in the land of Israel, but an Arab would be permitted to live in the land of Israel and even have rights of citizenship. But according to the Rambam, a Christian, or at least a Catholic, or a Greek Orthodox, would be an idolater and would not be allowed to even live in the land of Israel. That's a very big Kiddush. Now, this is the Rambam Shita. Now, what would the Rambam say? What would the Rambam say about different types of Protestants? So really, it depends. Christianity is many, many different groups. There are branches of Christianity, called Unitarian, for example, that essentially believes that Yashka is not God, that Yashka is like Mashiach or Messiah, whatever it would be. So those Christians would be like Muhammad. They would be like Islam. They believe in some ultimate Mashiach figure, but they do not say that it's divine or it's God. So as a result, they would be treated as Muslims, and they would be permitted. But most Christianity is Trinitarian-based, and as a result, it would be Avodah Zarah. Now, this is the Rambam Shita. Now, let me just mention, there is another view, and that is the view of Rabbeinu Tam. And Rabbeinu Tam is very, very chashuv. Rabbeinu Tam is Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, and this was Rashi's grandson, one of Rashi's grandchildren. In fact, legend has it, I'm sure it's a legend, I'm sure it's not true. You know, we have one of the big machloksim about tefillin is that there's Rashi Shita, how the parshios are in the tefillin, and Rabbeinu Tam Shita. We pass them like Rabbi, but people who are extra careful, plus many Hasidim and Sephardim, put on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin after davening or after Chazaras Hashatz and the like. So legend has it that when Rabbeinu Tam was a baby bouncing on his Zaidi's knee, and Rashi wore tefillin all day, this is what we know, he actually used to pull off Rashi's head tefillin, as if to say, gotta change it, you know, whatever. I think that's probably not true. But the reason why he was called Rabbeinu Tam, just as a little biographical information, is because it's a pun. Yaakov Avinu is described as Ish Tam, a perfect person, Yoshev Ohalim, one who dwells in the tents of Torah, and Rabbi Yaakov Bar Meir was also called Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam in Maseches Bechoros actually says a very interesting thing. Rabbeinu Tam, who lived in France, Rabbeinu Tam lived as Rashi in a Catholic country. Rabbeinu Tam said that Christianity is not considered Avodah Zarah for non-Jews. Rather, he called it, the term that he used for the Trinity was he called it Shituf. Shituf means you combine God with other things, meaning it's a violation, let me put it this way, for a Jew, it would be a violation of Yichud Hashem. We believe there's only one God. So he says, Noachites are not prohibited in believing there is a supreme God plus other forces, and therefore, although Christianity, now again, obviously, Rabbein Atam doesn't mean it's a true belief for Christians, because if it's false, it's false. I mean, if it's false for me, it's false for them. But he means to say that just because a belief is false does not mean it halachically is avodah zara. So according to Rabbein Atam, the halacha is that Christianity would not be, even Catholicism, would not be avodah zara. Now, obviously, to the degree that we allow Christians to live in the land of Israel, if there's any halachic justification, it would have to be based on the shita of Rabbein Atam rather than being based on the Rambam. Again, I have all the other mitzvahs to cover as well, so I don't want to be marach in this too much. I just want to point out that this is the common understanding of Rabbein Atam's shita. The Rabbein Atam maintains that Christianity is not idolatry for non-Jews. It is not a violation of the Noahide law. That will still not permit selling land to a Christian, because there's a separate iser of lo sechaneh, but that would permit Christian residence in the land of Israel. Now, I do want to point out that the Nadav Yehuda, great Pesach, the Rav of Prague in the 1700s, has a different understanding of Rabbein Atam, and he actually comes to a maskana, a very chomer maskana, that even Rabbein Atam would be moda, that Christianity is avodah zara, and Rabbein Atam is just referring to a very specific context. Let me tell you the specific context. The specific context of the Gemara is whether you're allowed to have a non-Jewish partner in business. And the Gemara initially says you're not allowed to have a non-Jewish partner in business because maybe in the course of business the non-Jewish partner will take an oath, and he'll take an oath in the name of his avodah zara, and you're not allowed to cause the person to take an oath in the name of avodah zara. And on that, Rabbein Atam says, you're allowed to be a partner with a Christian today because it's not really avodah zara. So the Nadav Yehuda wants to learn, Rabbein Atam is not mocking Christianity for the Noahide. He is simply saying it's not prohibited to cause a shavua, which is really just a peripheral issue. So there is a machlokas per se how to learn even the permissible view of Rabbein Atam. So like the Rambam, for sure it's avodah zara. Like Rabbein Atam, some understand Rabbein Atam that it's not avodah zara, and then Yehuda understands that even Rabbein Atam is moda than it is avodah zara, but it's not as chomor that you can't cause him to make a shur. Did you want to say something? Yeah.
I had a question. They are chayav in no other gods, correct?
Yeah, but that's correct. But that would refer to equal gods, meaning they're permitted to believe in that God. Again, the way the Trinity works is you have the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. What that would mean is that there is a supreme God that took on physical forms in different ways. So that, he says, non-Jews, according to the permissible interpretation of Rabbein Atam, non-Jews do not have that prohibition. Now, Eastern religions raises a whole other thing. Eastern religions like Buddhism and the like, which actually do exist in Israel, they are considered to be idolatrous, almost like all views. And if you go to Haifa, there's a huge temple, Baha'i Temple, one of the beautiful buildings there, and you know. What is Baha'i? Baha'i, by the way, is not some ancient religion. Baha'i was invented. I like the way people invent the new religions in 1920 or whatever. It's like, and then they say it goes all the way back. But it's an amalgamation. So the Eastern religions are very, very problematical. And in particular, it's disturbing because many Jews are attracted, especially to Eastern religions. You know that 90% of the converts, the English-speaking converts to Buddhism, 90%, 9 out of 10 are Jewish people. It's an amazing thing. Of course, I can give you a little reason for that. According to some midrashim, you know, we're going to read in a few weeks that Avraham Avinu, after Sarai Imenu died, Avraham Avinu took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And according to Rashi, which is based on a medrash, Keturah was actually Hagar, the woman that he was with, but she had been sent away with Yishmael. And after Sarah died, he took Hagar back, and she was called Keturah because her deeds were as pleasant as Ketores, incense. And from Keturah, he had children, and those children were sent to the east with many gifts. He sent them away. So according to some midrashim, the gifts that Avraham gave the Bnei Keturah were the various wisdoms of the Orient, the wisdoms of the Eastern religions, actually came from Avraham. They then got mixed up and perverted into idolatrous ideas, but to the degree that there's some truth in them, they actually come from Avraham Avinu. So we Jews make a lot of claims. Not only do we claim to be the basis of the Western religions of Christianity and Islam, we claim to be the basis of the Eastern religions, Buddhism and the like. And whatever is true in those religions, whatever is true, and there will be kernels of truth, come from the Moreshes, from the legacy of Avraham Avinu. So again, if a Jew is attracted to it, in a sense, it's an indirect attraction to the kochos of Torah.
I have a question in regards to how, you know, the concept that Jews have Hashem as our, we don't have any intermediaries. Yeah. So the Goyim, they have intermediaries. So how does that concept take place? Because maybe they're just worshipping their intermediary because they don't have a connection to Hashem.
Yeah, right. That's a very good point. Again, indeed, you are correct that non-Jews essentially are a God that deals with them via the intermediaries, like the secretaries of state and the like. But the difference would be that if you believe in many gods, what you're doing is you're assigning a certain equality to them. And that becomes a bodhisattva. Meaning if you're a non-Jew, you believe in a supreme God, but God simply delegates to intermediary forces, that would not be idolatry under the Noahide code. That would be exactly what you're supposed to think.
Is that the Shituf you were kind of saying?
Yeah, but the Shituf is a little different. The Shituf, it's more complicated. It's not simply an intermediary. The Shituf means that God himself is split into different portions. Meaning the Shituf is not simply God is the president and God has a vice president, but rather God himself has multiple identities, split personalities. And that would be a violation of believing in one God. Okay, so even though it all comes from one God, but once you say God splits, you know, that creates problems with nobody's heart. Okay, so that's the issue of idolatry. Okay, so that's the first Noahide law, right? Not to worship idols or not to believe in other gods, to believe in one Hashem. We then have things that parallel, to some degree, the Ten Commandments. Don't kill. Now, that, of course, is the same as the Torah says. But it's interesting that even when a Noahide law is the same as the Doraisa, it's not always the same. Let me give you one example. One outstanding example is the law against abortion. You know, the halakha is that although the killing of a fetus is against halakha, you're not allowed to abort a fetus, but the Gemara says beferish that abortion is not the same as murder. So, for example, if I kill a person and I was warned by witnesses, I could be executed. I could get the death penalty. If I kill an unborn fetus, I am not chay of misa. The Gemara says that. Nevertheless, if a non-Jew kills an unborn fetus, it is a capital crime that is equivalent to murder. The Torah is more chamor in punishments for non-Jews who violate this than Jews. And the Gemara has a drasha that we know that abortion is murder for Noahites, because the Torah says, we just read it last week, Shofech dam ha'adam bi'adam, he who spills the blood of a person, now in English it would be translated by another person, meaning you hire a hitman, his blood shall be spilled. But the Gemara Darshins, Adam bi Adam, literally means a person in a person. He who kills Adam bi Adam. So what is an example of a person within a person? That's an ubar, that's a fetus, and the Torah says that is prohibited.
Just curious if the stringency applies to all seven of the Noahide laws or just to something?
No, actually, it does apply to all seven. Every single Noahide law, there's a chiyuv mitzvah. It's very interesting. Even for theft, which I'm going to get to. Say again?
But then the first one where Christianity stuff would be okay for them and not for us, that seems the opposite. So it seems like it's more makel for them than
it
is for us.
Well, let me put it this way. There are going to be cases. Yeah, that's right. There are going to be cases where the law is more makel. Meaning it's not consistent that it'll always be stricter. But
okay.
I'm saying, but the punishment is always stricter. Or at least the same. Yeah.
And in the case of an abortion that's dangerous to the mother, for when there's no dineroide from the baby?
So that's a big machlokas. That's a very big machlokas. We know in halacha, the Mishnah tells me, if the unborn baby is endangering the mother's life, so you are commanded to kill the fetus in order to save the mother. And the Rambam says, based on the Gemara, that the reason is, why do you kill one to save the other? Lives are equal. Because we say the baby is a rodev. Since the baby is threatening the mother, so you're allowed and even commanded to kill the baby to save the mother. The mother might be able to say no, but unless she says no, you have to do it. So there's an interesting question. If abortion is prohibited for B'nai Noach, would abortion be permitted to save the mother's life? Is there a heter of rodef by B'nai Noach? That's a big, big machlokas. And indeed, there are poskim that maintain that you are not allowed. In fact, I'm trying to think. I believe, I believe that is even the Catholic Church's position. Which is interesting because they're following Allah. I believe the Catholic Church takes the position that you cannot abort a fetus even to save the mother's life because they basically say you can't kill one life to save another. Now, Judaism changes that because Judaism believes in, our halacha is that because of Rodev it's mutter, but some say that for Goyim, for the Sheva Mitzvah B'nai Noach, you don't have a heter of Rodev. So this would be a rare instance where the Catholic Church may have gotten it right in terms of what the halacha would be for non-Jews.
All the more so, if you can't kill them, wouldn't the baby be high for killing the mother?
If you can't do what again?
If a non-Jew can't kill or murder, then wouldn't the baby then be high for killing the mother?
Well, okay, so let me ask you a general question. We know, for example, that a katan, let's say in Jewish law, if you're katan, you're below bar mitzvah, and you kill or steal, you're not chayav because you're a katan. So I guess your question would be, is there an exemption of katan under the laws of B'nai Noach? Yeah. And there is, of course, that a baby, a fetus, is certainly a katan. Yeah, so the evidence is there is a din of katan as well. Meaning except the only thing is the Chassam Sefer says a very interesting thing. The Chassam Sefer says there is a rule that you have to have a certain age of majority to be chayav under the Noahide laws. And a baby will not be chayav for killing or for any other sin. But the Chassam Sefer says very fascinantly that it is not totally on an automatic age. You know, in Judaism, right, you're automatically a gadol when you're 13. So you could be the most brilliant, 8-year-old, and you know exactly what you're doing, and you make it, you're smart enough to make an atom bomb, and you blow up New York City, but you're not chayav. I'm a cotton, I'm only a kid, what do you want? whatever it could be. On the other hand, you could be 13-year-old, not too smart, not too bright, but you're not a shaita, as long as you're minimally competent, you're fully chayav. In other words, the way halacha works is that when you reach the right age, you're considered chayav. We don't start evaluating people based on how smart they are and everything else. The Chassam Sefer wants to be machadesh that by the Noahide laws, it's very interesting, there's no automatic age, whether it's 13 or 18 or 21. Rather, Beis Din, I'll discuss who the Beis Din is, the Beis Din evaluates whether the kid understands what he's doing. So theoretically, a 5-year-old, theoretically, might be fully responsible if he understands what he's doing. And theoretically, a 13-year-old or an 18-year-old might not be fully responsible. The Chassam Sefer says there's no automatic age of majority under Noahide law. It is simply an ad hoc evaluation of whether a person is considered to be competent and responsible. Yeah.
In the classical case of a Roedev, is there a din of Roedev for Goyim?
That's good for the machlok. I mean, the issue of abortion is good for that machlok. That is the machlokas. The goyim have a din of rodev, a permissibility to kill because of rodev. Okay. All right. So that's the second one. That's considered to be murder. Okay. So we have a bodhisattva, we have murder. Thank you. The third category is gilui arayos, forbidden sexual offenses. So non-Jews are not allowed to commit adultery, and non-Jews are not allowed to commit incest with blood relatives. Some of the halachas are a little different in terms of what is incest, meaning not all of the relatives that are forbidden by Torah law are forbidden by for non-Jews. But here I do want to point out that included in the prohibitions of Gilui Arayos are homosexuality, meaning to say the prohibition of, again, I won't say homosexuality is prohibited. That's a semantic, it's an important semantic distinction. Homosexuality itself simply means an attraction to same-sex. Now, the Torah does not prohibit an attraction. The attraction is simply a yetzer, just like the Torah does not prohibit your lust to eat chazer. Right? When I lust to eat chazer, I'm not transgressing anything, but I have a yetzer hara that I got to struggle with. So homosexuality is the same thing. The Torah does not prohibit the urge, although obviously if a person can work on those urges, that would be the best thing to do. But the Torah prohibits acting on the urges. Right? So the Torah prohibits the behavior, as it were. And that is why when there's a movement throughout the United States, certainly, and in other parts of the world as well, even in Israel, to legitimate gay marriage or whatever it is, it's absolutely usher. It's not only usher because it's a violation of the Torah for Jews, but it would be a violation of the seven Noahide laws because homosexual relation is nichlal in the iser of Gilui Arayos as well. By the way, there's something especially bad about gay marriage. It's very fascinating. You know, we're going to read in 2 weeks about Sodom and Amorah, the destruction of Sodom. Now, although the pashtus of why Sodom was destroyed, and indeed this is clear, no one's chalak in this, was because of their selfishness and their cruelty. Right? This is the main avera. The main avera was Saurus Lion. By the way, Derech Agam, it's very fascinating. Very, very fascinating. Rav Zevin gives a good hora. Wait a second. Sodom gets destroyed because they're cruel, they don't give charity, they don't have achnasas orchim. Which Noahide law says that non-Jews have to give charity? Meaning, you're punishing them for something they weren't commanded to do. So Rav Zevin says the following idea. Rav Zevin says, and this is important, that caring about other people, you don't need a command for it. That's something, as a human being, you should naturally know to do. So he says, in a sense, you have to supplement the seven Noahide laws with the basic decency that a human being has for other people. And again, this is an interesting idea. So actually, the seven Noahide laws could be expanded by basic ideas that a decent person knows. And they can be punished for that. They can be destroyed. See, sometimes people say, oh, show me where the Shulchan Aruch says I got to do a certain thing. There is a concept in life that a person should understand a basic morality in the world. And to live without that morality, it makes no difference if you could find a chapter in the Shulchan Aruch or whatever it is. Okay. But be it as it may, although Sodom was nanash because of its selfishness, it is also true that they were nanash because of Mishkav Zachor, because of the rampant homosexuality. That the word sodomy in English is taken from the idea of Sodom and the like. And that is why when the Malachim come to Lot, and the people of Sodom surround the house and they say, give us your guests, that is what they are referring to, therefore. Now, the Gemara in Chulin and the Medrash says the following idea. It says, Sodom was not punished for Mishkav Zachor until they started writing a kesuvah for it. Now, which means the following. When they were Stamazoi doing Averos, But when they wanted to make it official with a ceremony, with a kesuvah, that's when it became a bad thing. Which means, this is an important tashkafa generally. There's a big nafkamina between doing an aveira, when you know it's an aveira, even if you're doing it, versus legitimating it, koshering it, elevating it, making it turn into a mitzvah. Because when you do an aveira, of course, aveiras are bad. We shouldn't do aveiras. And Hashem is going to hold us to account. But when you do an aveira and you know it's bad, so no, all right, the Yetzer Hara got you. That's a very bad thing. But at least you know what you're doing is wrong. But when things get really bad is when you redefine that which is wrong and it turns into that which is good. And that's what the Medrash means. It wasn't the aveira which caused their destruction. It was their legitimation of the Aveira by a ceremony, by an official ceremony. That's why I saw in my own home, not my hometown, but where I used to live near Washington, D.C., that such a novella. They had a gay marriage on YouTube, but they had with Sheva Brachos and Chuppah, and all sorts of things. And that's mamish what the Gemara says. That's a bigger avla than the aveira itself, is the idea of making it as if it's holy and if it's elevated and the like. Okay. So we have what? So we did three. Briefly, we did avodah zara, we did shvich hastamim, murder, we did giloy arayos, and the like. Now, we then come to geza. Geza is theft, stealing, right? Not allowed to steal. Now here is where things get a little strange. Of course, Jews are not allowed to steal as well. And we know how chamor theft is. In fact, we read that the Aveira, which caused the destruction of the generation of the flood, was the sin of theft and gezel. The Gemara does say that the laws of theft for non-Jews are stricter than Jews. Again, it's not always a consistent pattern, in the sense that for a Jew, if it's less than a shaver pruta, it's not called gezel. They take something less than a pruta. Let's call it a penny, although it's not exactly a penny. But for non-Jews, even less than a shaver pruta is considered to be gezel. Okay, that's fine. Now, of course, that's interesting because a lot of things people take, let's say you take a paper clip from an office, so we could say it's less than a shaver pruta, but for a non-Jew, it's gezel. But here is where things get more disturbing. As I indicated before, any violation of the Noahide laws carries the death penalty. Okay, so for avodah zara, for murder, for gilui arayos, that's not so troubling because the truth is, you know, for Jews also that has the death penalty and the like. But now we have gezel. So let's say a non-Jewish person lifts an apple off an apple cart. I'm walking in the street, not me. Let's say a non-Jew just takes the apple, eats the apple. He could be killed. He's chayav misa. Chayav misa for gezel, and not only that, but chayav misa for gezel, pachas mishever pruta. A guy took a paperclip home from work, one paperclip at home, so the next day he gets shot in a firing squad, whatever it is, because he took a paperclip. You know. Now that sounds pretty bad, meaning, are we saying that's how a society should be run? Now, moreover, let me just clarify something about the death penalty of Noahites. There are a lot of interesting questions about it. You know, there was a book, a sefer, that some people wrote a few years ago, how you're allowed to, they got in trouble with the police, actually, how you're really allowed to kill Arabs on sight because all of them are violating all of these Noahide laws, and since they violate Noahide laws, they're chayav misa, and you can shoot them. I mean, let's just ask ourselves a few questions here. Let's take, we know that in order to give the death penalty to a Jew, you need a Sanhedrin of 23 judges. You need the Beis HaMikdash. You need eyewitnesses who saw it. And the person needs to be warned. In other words, there are many, many conditions for a Chiyuv Misa, and we can't do them. We don't have a Sanhedrin today. We don't have a Mikdash today. Right? So look at all the conditions. Eyewitnesses who are kosher. By the way, men who are kosher, Shomer Shabbos. Eyewitnesses. Warning. You need a Sanhedrin of 23 judges, which we cannot have today because we don't have the unbroken ordination, and you need a Beis HaMikdash. What conditions do you need, halachically, in order to impose the death penalty on a Noahite with the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. So the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, you don't need two witnesses, even one witness is good enough. You don't need warning. You don't have to give the person warning, right? The first, right? So here's the question. You don't need a Sanhedrin. So here's the question. If you don't need a Sanhedrin, so if I see a non-Jew stealing an apple, I'm not talking about maker's dough, am I just allowed to kill? So that's a big machlokas. The machlokas is, does halacha, don't report me to the police, does halacha recognize what you might call vigilantism in the Noahide law, or do you still need a court, even a non-Jewish court? Okay, so that's a big machlokas. There are some shitas, this is what this book was trying to argue, that say, you see a non-Jew violate the Noahide law, you can pull out your gun and kill him. Others say, this has to go to a court, the Cholapachas. Now there's another machlokas that's very important. Although there aren't that many Makaris in Rishayna, but it's discussed in Achronim. And that is, when Halacha says that the punishment for violating the Noahide law is death, does that mean that that's the mandatory punishment? Or does the Torah mean that Noahide non-Jewish societies are permitted to go up to the death penalty, but they are permitted to devise lesser sentences? In other words, if you have, let's say, a typical law that says, if you steal, you go to jail, is that a violation of the Noahide code or not? So that would depend. If the halacha is that the death sentence is a mandatory thing, then yes, a society is not allowed to say, you go to jail. But I know Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and some other people have argued that the kavana of the halacha is not that they're mechuyev to impose the death penalty. Rather, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving their society. See, unlike the Torah, where the Torah gives you a very specific punishment, the Torah essentially says to non-Jewish societies, you can give any punishment you want, even up to the death sentence. But if the society wants to give a lesser punishment, they can do it. Okay, so that's a very important machlokas. And most people seem to understand that the death penalty is mandatory, but there is, again, the very chushur of people who say not. That's why Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was against the state of Illinois imposing capital punishment. Murder and the like. And someone said, how could you be against it? The Torah says, if non-Jews violate the Noahide laws, you have death penalty. He says, well, death penalty is the maximum. The Torah is not saying that's what they should do. The Torah is saying that's what they could do. If it's necessary, they're not mechuyev to do it. Okay. All right. So we've done, right. So again, just going through a list today. We did Avodah Zarah, Shevichas Damim, Gilui Arayos, Gezel, okay, that is four. Then we have Eiver Min HaChai. Now, Eiver Min HaChai is prohibited for a Jew as well. Eiver Min HaChai simply means if a limb is severed from an animal while it is still alive, even if the animal then dies, it makes no difference. So that Eiver is prohibited to be eaten because it was severed from a live animal. That is Eiver Min HaChai, and that is usher for a Jew, but that is also one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. Now, in a more general sense, we could say that Eiver Min HaChai represents a law of no cruelty to animals. Now again, that's not only because of that, because L'maisa, even if I didn't cut off the limb, I can't eat that limb. But the aside of it is that obviously amputating a limb from an animal that is alive is an act of cruelty and the infliction of pain, and the Torah requires that Jews and non-Jews don't engage in behaviors that create the tzar bali chayim. Now, it's interesting that included in this, see, sometimes there are more as drushas that include other things, is that there is a problem. One of the laven in the Torah is, we are not allowed to castrate animals. Castrate, cut, mutilate the genitals. So the emphasis is that is even forbidden for a non-Jew under the Noahide law, that non-Jews are not allowed to castrate animals. Again, it's not the same as Avraham and Achai, but it's an offshoot of Avraham and Achai. Now, this, by the way, creates enormous halachic problems. If any of you want to be a veterinarian, or if any of you want to be, you know, you want to own a dog, or even cats, that is one of the things that the way that the average, you know, unless you work in a zoo and you work with lions and tigers and elephants, you know, the average bread and butter parnasa of a veterinarian is spaying, neutering dogs and cats. Right? That's the typical parnasa. Now, similarly, if you have a dog, it's very, very important. You know, as a pet owner, you know, get the dog spayed or whatever it is. And the reason is, number one, you don't want to bring in, you know, a million puppies into the world. But number two, unneutered animals can be very aggressive. They can actually be a little dangerous, and the like. Problem is, of course, that there is an issue the oraisa to castrate. Now, the minhag of what many people do is, in order to permit the castration of their animal, is like chametz. They sell their animal to their non-Jewish friend, and their non-Jewish friend brings it to the non-Jewish veterinarian. But the emes is, it's very difficult to see how that could be a heter, because if a non-Jew is not allowed to get the animal castrated, then by you selling your animal to a non-Jew, you're Avraham Lifnei Iver, you're causing causing a non-Jew to do a violation of the Noahide law is a sin for you. The same Lifnei Iver that says I'm not allowed to cause a Jew to sin, also says I'm not allowed to cause a non-Jew to sin. So it's very difficult. And of course, if you're not just the pet owner, but you're also the veterinarian, you even have a bigger difficulty. How do you practice your trade? So what some veterinarians do is, they don't do the final cut, meaning to say they set up everything, they tie everything, and the final, you know, they cut into it, you know, an inch or whatever it is, and the final one who finishes the job will be the non-Jewish nurse. But again, even if that means I was a diver, but I'm causing the non-Jewish person to be diver. So it's very, very difficult. So I would recommend if any of you get a dog, buy a dog that's already neutered, so you don't have to face the problem. I will say this, this is being developed, this is an important thing for pet owners to know, that the prohibition of castration is only physical, anatomical castration. That's when you actually cut something away. They've developed now chemical castration. In fact, they use it for rapists, they use it for people also, in which you drink something or there's an injection and it causes the tissue to shrivel up and not be functional. That actually is halakhically permitted. That is halakhically permitted because the Torah's emphasis is on the surgical removal of things, not on chemically rendering them impotent. Yeah.
If you're a veterinarian and you like you get up to the final cut, you don't actually like ask your non-Jewish nurse to cut it, but you just like you pretend like a shoppist or something and say like, I wish this like castration was finished.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
We rely on those heterim, but still, you are causing the person to do whatever. Meaning, see, this is the big difference when it comes to Shabbos. See, you understand the difference when it comes to Shabbos. The guy has no sin in violating Shabbos. So it's only me. I'm not supposed to ask. So if I hint, if I do this and that, you know, it's fine. But with castration, they're doing the sin. They're doing a sin too. So even if you're hinting, you're still the one that is responsible. It's a very big difference between Shabbos and this, because Shabbos, there's no aveira that they're doing. So as long as you can cleanse yourself, you know, from the taint of asking, you might be in good shape. But that's not, it's very difficult to see that as a logical heter when it's an avera they're not allowed to do. Yeah.
Wait, if they're going to do it anyways, that it's less of a problem?
Well, I don't mean they're going to do it anyway. I mean, if this is a nurse in your veterinary clinic, I mean, she's only going to do it if you...
If it wasn't your animal, it would be another animal. That's not a pesa?
It's hard to see how that's a heter because Lamaisa, if you're doing it, you're doing it, and if you're causing your nurse to do it, there's no even. Yeah.
Just to add to Yossi's question, say it's not your practice and you're just being employed, and so you write in your contract or something, you say like I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
Then maybe you're not causing other people to do it.
Okay, no, that might be so. Oh, that might be so. I mean, listen, if you're the anesthesiologist, you know, for the dog, that's you know, you're not really the one that's causing it. That might be true, even though you're an accessory. But if you're the guy, if you're the Jewish doctor, so the nurse is doing it because of you. All right, so these are things to think about. Okay, we'll stop. We'll finish off next time. That's good to know these.